Sam Gilkes, the IU in Montreal, 15 August 79.
The question we face now is which way to go from here. This question, an appropriate answer, is posed by Lewis Carroll in Alice in Wonderland, as shown in the first slide. In this classic story, the smiling Yankee cat responds to Alice that our direction depends on our goals. There are many possible directions to go in the future. These are the alternatives, large and small, which appear in the pre-assigned title of my talk. Turn the slide off, please. The dictionary meaning of the word alternate is to interchange successfully. Unfortunately, we do not have enough information at this time to discuss alternatives in this sense. Instead, we are forced at this time to discuss complementary strategies. Which will be successful? It is like trying to predict which approach will lead to the successful cure of the dreaded disease. All we can be reasonably certain of is that if we do nothing, progress is likely to be slow. About 4 years ago, groups at the Ames Research Center in Mountain View, California, and at the Jeff Polson Laboratory in Pasadena, California, set out to develop a search strategy which had as its objectives to greatly expand the parameter space which had been observed to date, and to accomplish this with existing radio telescopes. Larger telescopes than now exist can be built both on the ground and in space and on the moon. Artists' conceptions of these are shown in the next three slides. I'd like to run through the next three quickly. Turn this off, please. Turn this off. We missed one slide of a sight map system.
You don't need to leave
them. My objectives today are not to discuss these potential systems, but rather to show what can be done with existing telescopes implemented with ultra-low noise radio receivers and with very large multi-channel spectrum analyzers. By very large, I mean spectrum analyzers with the capability of handling 1,000 channels simultaneously. 1,000,000 channels or more. The search strategy developed by these groups is based on observations to be carried out primarily in the terrestrial microwave window, here defined to be the range from about 600 megahertz to 25 gigahertz. This is the region where the sky brightness temperature is minimum. The search strategy rationale results from the premise that the nearest transmitting civilizations may be fortuitously close, or alternatively, any transmitting civilization may not be close, but could have transmitters much more powerful than our terrestrial standards. This rationale leads to two complementary observational approaches. Have the next slide. And the first of these, the discrete source, nearby solar transfer is a spectral class F, G, or P, and systematically searched with high sensitivity for very narrow band signals. In the second approach, the survey, the entire sky is scanned with lower sensitivity, but with larger frequency coverage. Scanned from 1 GHz to 10 GHz, plus a few additional bands of higher frequencies, whereas the discrete object search runs from 1 to 2 gigahertz, which perhaps some frequencies on the lower end and higher end. In 1,000 seconds, it's been imaging on each star. Sensitivities of the range 10 to 9.7 to 10 to 9.8 watts per meter squared are achievable for existing telescopes. The combined frequency resolution and sensitivity that we have aiming fall far outside that which has been used in radio astronomy. These flux densities correspond to 10 to 100 gigadensities in a 1 hertz bandwidth. The next slide shows the minimum detectable isotropic creative power as a function of distance. Can you raise the slide up, please? Can you raise the slide up? Good, thank you. Here we show the effective isotropic radiative power versus the distance as seen with a number of systems. This line right here corresponds to a survey of the entire sky with 64-meter antenna. The two center lines correspond to... Now leave it up. The center line corresponds to what can be done with a 26-meter antenna, and bottom line of what can be done with the Arecibo antenna, looking at discrete stars or other sources. We see from this figure that modest-sized telescopes can detect. Leave the slide on. That modest-sized telescopes can detect. About 10 to the 7 watts of effective radiative power out to about 10 light years at this region right here. In terrestrial units, calculating power levels for the range from about 10 to the 5th watts to 10 to the 7th watts. Plus, the discrete source surge will have just enough sensitivity to detect the strongest Earth-like television station out to about 10 light years. The All Sky Survey, on the other hand, can detect gigawatt transmitters, 10 to the 12 watts, which is slightly less than the most powerful radar system used on the Earth. The next slide shows, for illustration purposes, the sensitivity that can be achieved with some of the existing telescopes. Here we show a list of telescopes that we want to detect. All of these instruments with ultra-low noise receivers, which are a matter of fact with 2 or more than that they use today, but which are the system temperatures that are routinely used for deep space tracking and spacecraft. And over in this column, I list the velocities that can be achieved, ranging from 10 to minus 26, or the 60-foot antenna, up to 10 to minus 28 for Arecibo. The crucial technology for the search is large multi-channel spectrum analyzers. Such devices will make it possible to search large numbers of frequencies simultaneously. A digital spectrum analyzer with 300 megahertz of bandwidth and a billion channels is currently under construction at the Walton Laboratory. This device produces fast Fourier transforms in 10 megahertz seconds with 300 hertz resolution. A device developed at the Dean Research Center in collaboration with a group at Stanford University yields 10 to the 7 channels for 10 million with a resolution of 1 hertz. When combined, these two systems could operate simultaneously to survey a broad portion of the spectrum with a narrow band capability which could zoom in to produce a zoom-like system. The next slide shows the instrument concept. It is envisioned that the spectrum analyzer such as I discussed could be used at one or many telescopes and moved around. The idea is to record on two polarizations, pass each signal through a tunable laser amplifier with very low noise temperature into the receiver, into a large spectrum analyzer, and finally into a signal detector. Now, about schedule. I mentioned previously this program is still in conceptual stages. Our immediate plan is to begin a field test program early next year, using existing spectrum analyzers while operating with the same spectral resolution as I mentioned for the larger program. Our immediate goals are to learn more about the radio frequency background with high spatial and with high spectral resolution and to develop signal detection algorithms. This program is expected to run for 2 years. During this time, a decision will be made by NASA on the time schedule which we proceed with a full program. It is anticipated that instrument development could begin as early as 1982 and the full-on program could be in operation in 1984. Thank you.
Did you say the Millennium Channel analyzer is under construction?
A section of it is under construction. It's built in modular form. 65,000 channels are very good mutations.
We probably didn't go for a discussion of all three papers. That's like the call. My co-chair was here for any comments to be prepared tonight. Do you have any
Lutsky had said that he would make some comments in
the program. Yes. You made your comments then, did you remember to make them now?
Who might be sad?
All right, are there comments to Sebastian or Hannah?
One comment on that project. Professor, should we do it now? Now, we would like, first, a costly method, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. Second, we would like to have the best method. Now, the first one is fulfilled. We do have a method which is possible, and that is radio. Second, the best method we will never know to have. Not now and never in the future. We always will say wait for thousands more years and we will have a better one. So, the conclusion is, if we want to do it at all, we could as well start right now.
Thank you. Let me add something to that. We wait 100 more years and we may not even have radio.
Yes.
Because of the RFI problem. So, we're still so interested about initiating a radio search.
The activity which we call radio astronomy went to a galactic civilization to be remote sensing and correspondingly be more important. The search of the three of conduction to make the radio astronomy receiver could conceivably have been made in the quiet hole in the spectrum.
Are there any more questions?
Could they have any interest? Or IT tell us anything more about the interesting remarks that there are some Soviet efforts to move your way so you can stay?
Second motion, trustee.
Could you tell us about the millimeter wave light searches that are being done in space? What does the plan look like?
Many of the searches that have done so far have been 21 centimeters, where beyond aircraft is there is no transmission to protect the radio astronomers to occur naturally. But this not all to be true, but it's a
reason. Yes, it fit very well. I think that's a very good point. The point being that the only listener out of the year also hears better to listen than I can hear anything. And this is one of the reasons why we wish to broaden these radio search out to a greater frequency band that has sort of wasn't covered with any detail or findings of cone. In that connection, I'd like to say that it seems to me that the progress, if there has been any over the past few years, of radio search has as a dimension centered around the technology relating to the rapid processing of huge amounts of data. It was realized from the very beginning that to search the entire radio spectrum was hopeless. Even to search the microwave window was very, very difficult. And this was the reason for Tony and Morris's suggestion of the concentrator activities near the signpost of the hydrogen line. It happens to be, of course, a very vicious part of the spectrum. We'd like to broaden the search out from that very narrow part of the spectrum to wider parts, and only recently has this become possible through the advent of large-scale integrated circuits. The multi-channel spectrum analyzers that we referred to in the last paper are in fact a result of that large-scale integration revolution that's taking place, and we've not seen the end of that. It seems to me quite likely that over the next few years, this technology will advance to the point where we can reasonably talk about billion channel spectrum analyzers. And also, I think very cogent, these analyzers would not necessarily look for only very narrow band monochromatic signals or different monochromatic signals, but may look for pulses of various duration and other types of signals as well. In other words, we propose to look for not just stripes in the time direction, but maybe blobs in the frequency time plane of various aspect ratios corresponding to various kinds of signals that might be transmitted. The whole philosophy, of course, is to cover as many alternatives as we can, economically and reasonably, and to put our greatest effort where we think the probability is highest. That is, after all, the strategy of any search. We look for something you've lost, you look for the most likely places first, or the least likely places next, and then you go back and look for the most likely places again in case you didn't see them for the first time. Are there further comments or additions to the question we just had? Yes, one more.
Has the United States any plans for antennas replacing the
I think I can answer that question to say that there have been investigations of what this would involve. Following the Cyclops study, when the NASA people took on a continuing effort in looking at the radio search, studies were made, especially by SRI, under NASA funding, of alternative systems for large antenna structures based on antenna considerations and needs. They are competing means of getting large collection area, but all the figures are not in yet. Well, if there are no more questions, I would like to thank our speakers for this session for their presentations, and I'd like to thank the audience for its attention and for sharing this session. Thank you very much.
That was the end of the first two sessions, and the third session was not recorded. That was about biology, search for life in our own solar system, and search for planets around other stars using astrometric and interferometric methods. This is now the recording of the fourth and last session of the day, 15 August 79 at the IAU in Montreal.
Well, this session is about the manifestations of advanced civilization.
If the teacher and the whistle will come on, also this will stop again.
And it's a little difficult session because from the two co-chairmen, one hasn't manifested himself, and from the three speakers, two have Isaac. And so we have only one speaker from one program speaker to start with. And then the rest I will try to fill out a little, and I will use the help of the audience as much as I can. So partly this will turn into a workshop if you allow me. And now I will ask Dr. Suleiman to start out this eavesdropping. And we will
I thought I did 45 minutes, but I told it was still 1:15 minutes. So you're safe. Well, there are many ways to cut the extraterrestrial pie, as you've heard today. We've discussed many types of issues, and I want to consider one aspect which has received less attention today, namely the nature of the message that we might receive and the nature of the signal it carries. The implicit assumption in much of what has been said is that we will be looking for purposeful signals. Beacons of some kind have been set up. But I would like to consider the other alternative, namely the detection of inadvertent signals, either interception of interstellar communications between other civilizations, as was mentioned earlier, or possibly leakage from a planet, which is of an inadvertent nature. Now, which is the best strategy in terms of setting up one's search strategy depends on, number one, the nature of the signals and their strength, of course, and their other characteristics. And number two, the longevity of such signals. How long will civilizations either be leaking or purposely setting out beacons? And the latter is really the key unknown, this famous factor L in the rate equation. We just don't know. And since it is unknown, I think we should examine the second hypothesis every bit as much as we examine the first hypothesis of purposeful beacons. Another way to state this is Carl Sagan's assumption of mediocrity, which is really just a restatement of the Socratic principle of know thyself. Namely, if we're going to look into this, let's look at the only civilization we do know anything about, Earth, and see what it tells us about possible other civilizations. And so, myself and a couple of students, Brown and Wetherill, have considered the radio leakage from Earth, and also, of course, have considered the fact that there have been only 2 minutes of purposeful signals sent out from the Earth, from Arecibo in 1974. Not really a serious attempt, just a demonstration that it could be done. Whereas we have been leaking now for 30 years in a reasonable fashion. So we considered what sort of information could you get from this leakage? How strong is it? What are its other characteristics? And I'm going to zip through the results now, since there's a limited amount of time, without giving a lot of justification, but there is further information available if anyone wants to ask questions or talk to you about it. We considered all of the various radio services that escaped from the Earth. This means frequencies higher, high enough to not be blocked by the ionosphere. So all of the short waves and the AM broadcasting is eliminated. And we wanted not too directional radiation because we want a lot of stars to be illuminated. And so this means that you want to have an antenna which has some gain, but not too much gain. It's pointing towards a reasonable fraction of the sky. It wants to be narrow band because if you have a given amount of power, the narrowest the bandwidth, the more you can detect it at a given distance, the easier you can detect it. And so we started looking around at all the various kinds of radio services there are in the world, everything from police cars to citizens band radio in the U.S. to ship to shore, weather radars, military radars, the whole business. And we came out with the fact that the most detectable kind of radiation at interstellar distances are the military-type radars, specifically the ballistic missile early warning system, which the United States maintains in North America. And I'm sure there's an equivalent system looking back from the Soviet side, looking back at us. This is about half a dozen huge antennas, which are spilling out a tremendous amount of power at VHF frequencies, 200 megahertz, in a reasonably narrow bandwidth. And I'll talk later about how far away they can be detected. However, we did not clue in on those because it turns out that they would not be as much information in them as there would be in the next level of power, namely television radiation. The military is always changing frequencies. The bandwidth is broader, and so it would be harder to get Doppler shifts and various other technical considerations. And so we moved in on TV, and that's what I'd like to talk about as an example of a leaking radiation. Now, most of you that know anything about radio will say, well, TV is 5 or 6 megahertz broad. How can it be of any use? Well, it turns out that half of the power in a television transmitter goes into the carrier. It's only about 1 hertz wide if the engineer is keeping his thing tuned properly. And the other half is spread over the 5 megahertz. So there's a tremendous amount of power in a very narrow band. And if you look at the characteristics of TV signals as we have done in the field, as well as extensive discussions with people in Europe and in the US, we find that it's a reasonable model to consider these things as narrow band beacons of a certain kind that are inadvertently leaking from the Earth. The first slide
will show us, we didn't have to do a lot of homework to find out where the TV transmitters were on the Earth. And here is the distribution. You see there's hardly a non-random distribution around the globe. Very heavily concentrated in North America and in Europe. Unfortunately, I did not have complete information about the Soviet Union. I believe that that would just extend the blackening, say 500 miles further to the east of where I have information. China, there's virtually no TV of any importance for this problem. So we have all of these transmitters. We put the entire thing into a big computer program, spun the Earth, and put in a standard antenna pattern for the television. Next slide will show you the nature of that. I'm sorry, this shows you the frequency distribution. They're concentrated into three frequency bands. Notice that this is a much lower frequency than we've been talking about earlier in terms of the microwave window, which usually is 1 gigahertz or greater. This is down in the sub-gigahertz region. Next slide. This shows you what a TV antenna does. You send your power out along the horizon. You don't want to send your advertising dollars, at least in the U.S., straight up ahead. You send along the horizon, and most of it, or at least 50% of it, a lot of it will even reflect and go out, but at least half of it will just keep on going and leave the Earth. Incredibly small fraction, of course, ever hits a TV antenna on a roof. And so, if you now spin the Earth and ask the question, what would the Earth look like at interstellar distances with a standard radio telescope, then we get the next slide, which shows you the power that you would receive over one sidereal day from the Earth. And this is now totally all frequencies, but if you look at any narrow band, you would get a similar sort of pattern. You get these striking peaks, which is due to the concentration of stations in North America and in Europe. And some of these peaks are labeled. But notice that North America gives you two peaks a day, not just one. This is because, as seen from the transmitter, whenever the star rises or sets, it is blasting the star. It takes tens of years, hundreds of years to get there, but it's blasting the star twice a day. And so you will see a given transmitter twice a day. And the different peaks, here's Australia's little peak down here, and so forth, can be labeled by us. These will be peaks A, B, C, D, E, F, and so forth, for the extraterrestrial to figure out what to do with. This is from Barnard's star, which is near the equator. And so you can see pretty much all of the stations. And notice the width here corresponds to about 30 degrees, which is the width of the transmitter, the width of the transmitter involved with the width of the longitude region where the stations are. You can even see the gap in the Great American Desert, as it used to be called, between the east and west coast here. Next slide. Now this is as seen from a southern star, and now of course the star is scraping the southern horizon as seen to the northern hemisphere, and so you get broad peaks that never really get out of the transmitter beam. And so you get a single peak, it doesn't quite get to be a single peak. This star went out of the beam a little bit and then came back down. Notice that they're closer together in time. You only see the star rising and setting about 5 hours apart. And last slide, we'll show you a northern star, plus 60 degrees declination. And now, the star at northern culmination, as it scrapes the northern horizon, will really see a lot of stations at once. You don't get much from Western Europe here because the star never gets down near the horizon. So the point is that, depending on your aspects or your declination, you'll get different views. Now, this is the frequency of the power information. All of these narrow bands will be rotating on a platform, the Earth, and will be going around the Sun, and therefore you'll have loads of Doppler shifts. And these Doppler shifts, the next slide will show you an example. If you look with very fine frequency resolution down in the Hertz sort of range, which we're beginning to do now with SETI attempts, what you would see in about the most crowded portion of the spectrum that we were able to find, this is channel 3, and here are 13 stations in the U.S., scattered around the U.S., and this is separated by 2 hours of time. These are the spectra that you would get. You have a tremendous amount of information to play around with and try to figure out what's going on. A basic conclusion that we came to from this study was that the most detectable signal from the Earth is simply of a single station. You gain nothing by broadening your bandwidth to include more stations. So it's just a problem of finding the most powerful transmitter. And now, of course, the question is how far away can these be detected? For the strongest TV stations, the answer is a disappointing 2 light years. So you don't even get to Alpha Centauri. If, however, we look at the military radars, then we go out about 10 times, 15 times further. The 30 light years detected with an Arecibo type system, thank you very much, an Arecibo antenna with a similar sort of receiver sensitivity.
If we now ask, what should a Cyclops system receive, which is 1,100-meter antennas, which perhaps we might have in a couple of centuries, if not so, the next decade, certainly, then you go on another factor of 10 in distance, which remember is 1,000 in terms of illuminated stars. And then the strongest TV station can be detected is about 25 light years, which is 300 stars, and the strongest military system can be detected at 500 light years, where you're now getting into millions of stars that are illuminated such that they could be detected. Now, would the signal be recognized as artificial? If they had clever enough theorists, perhaps they could come up with a molecule that's doing the body rotations at the right spectrum and so forth. That's the right polarization. It seems rather unlikely. What about program material? I haven't talked yet about what's being sent out. The point is that you must broaden your bandwidth out to 5 megahertz in order to pick up the program. And that means that you have to have about 20,000 times more sensitivity, meaning a huge, much bigger dish, in order to get the program material. So I'm only talking about detecting what's called the video carrier, this narrowband component. So we don't have to worry about Gilligan's Island and Milton Burrow getting out there. Possible scientific deductions that you could make from this? Well, as you recognize, what we have here is a single-line spectroscopic binary. You see this G2 star in the same direction, you see these lines, and you can do exactly the same sort of information. The Doppler shifts are very easy to measure. You get the period, the eccentricity, the time of perihelion, etc., the mass function. If you can have enough astrophysics to know the mass of the star, which seems very reasonable, then in fact it turns out that you can get the true value of the astronomical unit, not just its projected value. Then with that, and the size of the Earth, which is very easily deducible from the period and the Doppler shift you're seeing in the daily rotation, you can then get the size of the Earth at a given distance and therefore work out what the equilibrium temperature is of the Earth, assuming there are no strong atmospheric effects. So you see, now you can go to your exobiology department and start talking to them about really what kind of life might this be that is giving us this. You can also get information about the Earth's ionosphere, which will be much more affecting the lower frequency stations, in terms of they will not come around every serial day as precisely because of a jitter in the ionosphere. Maybe even the troposphere will affect things because the tall towers, 1,000 meters high, will sway in the wind. This will be a seasonal effect. The beams will go back and forth. You'll be able to do this timing, actually. And you can, in fact, reproduce that entire map that I showed you using techniques that are quite analogous to how Doppler radar astronomers map Venus or Mars, even though they cannot resolve it. You simply map in the frequency-time plane. You would get a diameter of 6,000 kilometers, a radius rather. I think it's quite reasonable to say this is probably a planet, not a white dwarf or something. A fascinating thing is you can actually derive the size of the antennas that are doing the radiating. You assume they're diffraction limited. You have the width of the beam from each antenna as it comes around. You know it's 5 degrees or so, you know the frequency. Landover D tells you that these engineering structures are about 15 meters high. You get a tremendous amount of information using standard astronomical scientific techniques. Cultural deduction gets to be a little bit more speculative, to say the least. But take that map that you would have without the shorelines in it, and then what could you make of that? Obviously, there are people or the transmitters are avoiding certain regions for some reason. What is the reason for this? It wouldn't like an archaeologist that has a city plan of an ancient street, of an ancient city. He's trying to figure out the whole commerce and culture of the city just from that street plan. But I think there is more here than you might realize, because frequency conventions, for instance, are according to both political and geographical ties. And the frequency conventions in the different parts of the world, as to what frequency channel 3 is at and so forth, are directly measurable. You would wonder, now why is Japan's frequency convention the same as the US, yet they're separated by 10,000 miles? Do they have some cultural or political ties? And the answer, of course, is certainly yes, because television was adopted there when the US was occupying Japan after World War II. They would be able to deduce that. But the point is that they would be able to propose political and or cultural units. Well, finally, should we eavesdrop? And the answer, I think, is that we should do both things. Eavesdropping, we do not know how long any culture leaks as opposed to sending out purposeful signals, so it's a tie in that consideration. Information content for a purposeful code from a beacon, we must decode the signal. I think that's really something that's been ignored much more than it should have been. That's going to be much more of a problem to get useful information out of a purposeful signal than people have said, whereas the eavesdropping, as you see, did a tremendous amount, even without getting the picture in television. Range, well, obviously, purposeful beacons are much more effective than the tens and hundreds of light years I'm talking about here for our type of civilization. But supposing that they live on a much larger planet where communication needs are much larger, or supposing that interstellar beacons or interplanetary beacons have been set up in their planetary system, they could be far more powerful. And another thing that has been said, well, we're going to all have cable TV in 10 years. Maybe that's true. We may well have solar power satellites in 20 years also. Just about a part in a million leakage from the back of these solar satellites as they beam the microwave power down to Earth. And this is perfectly reasonable that this would exist, because it's of no importance from an engineering point of view, is far more powerful than any of these military radars. The point is that for any narrow band, repeatable type of signals, no matter what they're being used for, you can deduce the same kind of information. So I think we should think of eavesdropping perhaps in the view of something that will show up every bit as likely as purposeful signals. It turns out that your search strategy doesn't have to be a whole lot different. You're still looking for narrowband signals, but now they may well be drifting. You've definitely got to be looking for drifting signals, which makes it tougher to say the least. You also cannot appeal to magic frequencies. You just don't know what kind of frequencies. In this case, all you can do is blind searches at whatever frequency you might want to choose. In fact, we've looked at a couple of nearby stars, as I said this morning, at these kind of frequencies, looking for television-type leakage. So, to sum up, I think we should follow both strategies, because in the case of the only civilization that we do know something about, clearly we have been linking much more than we have been purposely sending out. Thank you. And actually saw these reflected television signals just to confirm the models of the sea. Here they are, and I was able to identify these by the frequency conventions. And next slide. This shows you the band on the limb of the Earth as we were looking from Arecibo, and so we could identify what we were seeing. Next slide is shows the growth in television power with time, so this bubble is tremendously getting strong with time. And the last one shows what might happen. Last slide, please. Doing our inadvertent message going out.
Thank you very much. Very interesting talk. And have any questions, comments from this talk?
Yes.
Are we happy? Well, does it in fact make sense that certain frequencies on Earth is troubled by the threat of interference? So we have to build cyclops and back setting.
It was extremely difficult because of the interference problem. That was our prime choice of frequencies at Arecibo when we did this demonstration and a couple of nearby stars, and just to search around where we could find some interference free band. The other great argument for us is that the galactic background is far noisier at these low frequencies, greatly reducing its sensitivity. However, all I can say is that if the signal is going up faster than the noise, and that's still the place you want to be looking in terms of optimal signal noise. They are feasible now, however.
Is it correct to say that nothing leaks out below the ionosphere cut off? A lot gets reflected, but there may be eventually.
Well, in fact, EHF radiation, now we're down in the kilohertz level, has been detected from satellites. You can see harmonics of power lines, once again concentrating over North America for obvious reasons. So there is this sort of thing, but when you look at the interstellar propagation problems with such low frequencies, that definitely argues against them in terms of dispersion and multipath scattering and so forth. But certainly at solar minimum, when the cutoff frequency goes down to a few megahertz, then you will have more leakage. But then, of course, the people using it for communication will tend to go lower frequencies also, for obvious reasons.
One thing was very interesting to me. One argument against all this was always that, well, this curve would sort of steep up all the power we leak. Well, once energy gets a problem, we'll come down because we don't want to waste any energy. And so it was very interesting for me that you turned the argument around. When we are short of energy, you will build space stations sending energy to Earth, and then there will be a lot of leakage. So you just don't know what the future will bring, and we have to do our best to search.
guess what you really have to do.
Oh, back there.
As you compare these powers to Jupiter-like Earth power and the five sun.
Yes, one density. Now, I'm not sure I can find the figure in my notes here, but the when you're using a 1 hertz bandwidth, even a TV station is something of the order of hundreds of times more powerful than the sun, the quiet sun. If you have a really bursty sun, then it might be compromised. There's no problem there. But I'm glad you asked about Jupiter, because this is a possible way we might detect planets, if I can go back to the last session, is looking for Jupiter-type low-frequency bursts. Turns out you need about 1,000 times the power of a Jupiter burst to detect it at tens of light years. But this is another possible way we might detect planets. And the signature is different from solar-type bursts, so you could identify that it was coming from a planet rather than from the star, if things were now for you. Okay, well, thank you very much. Now, the continuation of the session is, as I mentioned at the beginning, a little difficult. And I'll try to do my best and say a few things about astro engineering and space travel. And I will put both together because space travel also is kind of astro engineering. And put down a few things I just happen to know and will ask the audience about other things with their daughter. And then later on we'll have a discussion, and some have volunteered already, and some others will follow up maybe. Now, Frank Drake said we should never forget about dollars, and in that respect is right, although what is worth while is the only question. Now, I would like to start with things small and go to larger projects later. Could anyone tell me what the present NSF budget annually is?
$0.7 GDR.
Pardon?
0.7 gigadollars.
0.7 10 to the 9 dollars. Is that right?
Yes. Good.
So that is the present NSF budget. Then, if we now go to bigger projects which we have in mind, I will cite here the project Cyclops. And again, the number I have talked about a while ago was 10 times that. 10 times $10 billion. It might be a factor of 2-0, well, I don't know. And this would be the full project. Of course, it's not supposed to be starting small and growing slowly, but this would be the limit for a point on the scope. No, this is just the whole building of it, not the main. Now, you might say that is a ridiculous high number as compared to that. But on the other side, what else could we compare it with? And I will say another one of our big enterprises right now is the arms race. And that is at present about $400 billion per year. I know the exact number of 334 for 1976, now that's what we're trying
to do. Worldwide,
is it? Pardon?
Worldwide.
Yes, worldwide.
Worldwide.
Worldwide, yes. And of course, the United States and Soviet Union have the highest portion, but the Arabic countries did quite well. And here I would like to mention that nobody wants to stay behind. I would like to give these figures also for other reasons. Of course, we always speak about intelligent life in space, and the question is how much of that do we have on Earth? And this shows clearly that there isn't very much. And I'll give you another number which shows the same thing, and again in terms of dollars, and that is that the underdeveloped countries. Can't write anymore. Underdeveloped countries, and in the year 1976, where I have these numbers from, received from the developed countries $30 billion in 1 year, and in the same year spent $18 billion on arms, which means buying arms from the same countries where they got the economic help from, which means that what we call economic help is actually only